Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jonathan Curiel, journalist at the San Francisco Chronicle and author of All America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots, and I'll moderate tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Robert Baer, former CIA operative and author of the new book, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Mr. Baer is the author of two previous New York Times bestsellers, Sleeping with the Devil, about the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the United States, and See No Evil, a memoir that recounts Baer's years as a top CIA operative in the Middle East and elsewhere. See No Evil, which was subtitled The True Story of a Ground Soldier in the CIA's War Against Terrorism, was the basis for the George Clooney film Syriana. Baer, who has written for such publications as The Washington Post, Vanity Fair, and The Wall Street Journal, is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East. The Devil We Know is an extremely timely book, given Iran's importance, not just in Iraq, but as Baer makes clear, in Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and other places on the world stage. Please welcome Robert Baer.
Thank you very much. It's great being here. And if I have to cough every once in a while, I hope you don't mind. I don't know what I'm getting over. It seems like the bubonic plague, but I am over it, and I'm not contagious. Iran, I'm on a military blog these days, and we are talking about a lot about Iran and what it means, and what I keep seeing coming back is the reduction of Iran to a terrorist state. And the truth is, it is a terrorist state. It was a terrorist state. Very few of us in this country realized that we were at war with Iran from 1979 until 1996. It was a quiet war, assassinations, bombings, supporting of guerrilla groups. My first experience with Iran, and I like to tell the story, because I believe that all knowledge is, in a sense, real knowledge, deep knowledge, is built on suffering and tragedy. And I was in Beirut in 1982 and 1983 in the embassy, in the station. I wasn't there that day, but one beautiful day, the embassy sat on the corniche, the old embassy, and a pickup truck came by, a GMC pickup truck, drove down the corniche, parked in front of the Palm Hotel, and waited. It was about noon, and schools were just letting out. Beautiful day. People were walking up and down along the sea. Seagulls. Beirut's an absolutely fabulous city. We had just sent the troops into Lebanon to secure the peace. It was hope. President Reagan at the time truly believed that we were going to remake the Middle East based in Lebanon. It's a little before 12. A Mercedes comes roaring down the corniche, waves at this pickup truck. Pickup truck starts. The few people who remembered it was weighed down very heavily. It was carrying a very heavy load. Comes down the corniche very slowly, staying up with traffic. Right before the U.S. Embassy, it makes an abrupt left, drives under the portico, drives up the stairs, and explodes. For me, that was an absolutely traumatic event. A couple dozen Americans were killed, many Lebanese. The chief of station was killed, a colleague of mine, the deputy chief, his wife, the national intelligence officer for the Middle East was killed. The Marine on post one, they never found his body. The explosion was so intense. They just found the buttons from his tunic, the brass buttons. We're not talking about what we're... And I look at the world differently as a CIA officer. And I look at, immediately, when the investigation stopped, was the quality of the attack. The bomber, it was claimed by the Islamic Jihad organization, an organization that we knew didn't exist. It was simply a name on paper. The suicide bomber in the truck was never identified until this day. He's never been claimed. There's never been a decent source to come out with his name. I have my ideas who it was. I investigated this for 20 years. But what happened was important. The lives lost were a tragedy, but what happened after that was the importance, because in very quickly, in quick succession, we pulled out of Lebanon. We pulled out of a key listening post in the Middle East. It was a listening post for Saudi Arabia. It was a listening post for Syria, for the war on Israel. We left one man, one GMC pickup truck, 2,000 pounds of explosives, PETN, acetylene tanks. It's an operation, cost about $500, the whole thing. Pickup truck was stolen. This is the kind of effectiveness we had been worried about in terrorism for years. Now, what succeeded was even more devastating for our worldview, and that was over the next 18 years, that capacity, that expertise in terrorism was turned against the Israeli army in Lebanon. I look at the Middle East from the perspective of the Israelis and the Arabs and the Persians. It's very different from the way we look at it sitting in Lafayette or San Francisco. We tend to think in terms of the newspapers, the op-ed pages, who described this great war against terrorism. What scared us very early on about 1986 and 88 is the same people who blew up the embassy turned this to classical guerrilla warfare. They took the same expertise, which we had never seen in the 20th century or the 19th century, and turned it into a guerrilla army which became undefeatable. For those in the military here or served in the military, this Islamic resistance uses fiber optic cables, cables that go under the ground, and to intercept them, you actually have to get a hold of them and bend them to refract the light, which is impossible to do. In other words, this group was so capable, it shut off our ability to spy on it. The 2006 war, the Israelis were defeated. There's no other way to describe this. I got an email from the Deputy Defense Minister of Israel during that war. He says, I agree with your analysis 100%. And he is their expert on Iran. He said, we lost the war. This is a catastrophe for Israel. We are facing a superpower. Now, what we pieced together over these years, it was a small group of Iranians. It's called the Quds Force, the Jerusalem Force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which orchestrated essentially the takeover of Lebanon. It's the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps which orchestrated the war in Gaza, 22-day war. It is the same group that is now moving into Iraq. And this is how I arrive at this idea that Iran has become a superpower. It has become a guerrilla force like we've never seen, including Vietnam. The same guerrilla force that blew up our embassy, that defeated the Israelis, that started this conflict in Gaza, now sits on the oil routes. Oil has gone up to $54 a barrel. They have taken the same tactics they learned in Lebanon with rockets and have moved them to the northern side of the Gulf. Within 3 minutes, they can take out traffic. Within 3 minutes, they can raise the price of oil back to $150 or more, which way the economy is now. The Iranians have the capacity to shut us down in this country economically, truly drive us into a depression. It is not an offensive power. It's a deterrent power. They do not intend to do this. And then we come to Iraq. We are going to leave Iraq. I don't care if it's this president or the next. We are going to leave Iraq because Iraq is going to become what it's going to become. We've brought this insurgency to its knees thanks to the Iraqis, to the surge, to Anbar province. It's also thanks to the Iranians who do not want chaos in Iraq, because chaos in Iraq means it washes back across their borders into a Sunni-Shia conflict, What they want to do is wedge us out over the next couple of years. They don't care if it's Obama or it'd been McCain. They want us out. They want us out quietly. And they would like a friendly Shia government, not a subservient Shia government. Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, is not an Iranian agent. He was on their payroll for 20 years in Damascus and Beirut, but he is not one of their agents. Yet he knows that Iran is a power that's too large to challenge, too powerful to challenge, and it's too easy to compromise. This is where we got to have to look at the, we have to look at two things. Is we have to drop the word terrorism in Iran, because it doesn't do us any good, because they are much more dangerous than terrorists. They are a regional power that control, have the potential to control world's oil supplies, the price of oil. Two is we have to look at the facts in Lebanon. They are not terrorizing people in Lebanon. They are taking the country. Three is the Iranians have managed to cross this barrier between the Shia and the Sunni. I liken the Shia to Catholics and the Sunni to Protestants. The Shia are very disciplined. I spent 4 years doing documentaries on suicide bombings and hundreds and hundreds of interviews, and I walked away with the unmistakable opinion that the Shia control suicide bombings when they want to. When they don't, I mean, when they intend to use them, they use them against military targets. The Sunni do not. The Sunni have this view that their civilization is... I'm talking about extreme Sunni. I'm talking about Sunnis in general. Just like when I talk about Christianity, you talk about, you know, the people that, you know, Waco, Texas. We're talking about extreme Sunnis are the anarchists. They are uncontrollable. They are the ones that attacked us on 9/11. These are divisions we rarely look at in this country. So what we're facing in Iran is a very capable power, very patient power, a power that does not have our interests at heart. Yet the fact is that it's a military power, and all military powers, military dictatorships, if you like, can be dealt with. We cannot look at Iran and look at Ahmadinejad and think that's the future of Iran. He doesn't have any power. He does not have his finger on the trigger. He cannot take Iran to war. He can drive its economy into the ground, which is dangerous in itself, but he can't take the country to war. That's good news. Khamenei, the spiritual leader who answered Obama's address, his Nowruz address, is the true leader. Now, I've noticed in the press that it's been reported that Obama's message to the Iranians was rebuffed. I don't look at it that way at all. What Khamenei says is we're listening, but we want to see a quid pro quo. What do the Iranians want? It's very simple. They want their money back that we took after the takeover of the embassy from 79. They want sanctions released. They would like reciprocity in the Gulf. They would like to be recognized as the key power in the Gulf, as the key military force. They would essentially like to be the equal of the United States in the Persian Gulf. Now, our question should be, do we accept them as that? And this goes back to the terrorism factor. The last Iranian attack on the United States, acknowledged, documented, was in 1996 in Khobar Barracks. It was done through Hezbollah, the Hejaz, killed 19 American servicemen. But that was the last one. And do we forgive Iran? This is 12, 13 years ago. Is 13 years enough time to put behind us? And this comes to the point is, what can we do in the Middle East? I think that the idea of creating democracy in Iraq on paper was a brilliant idea. But like every idea on paper, it didn't often work. And it's not going to happen. Iraq, as Churchill called it, is a vengeful volcano. No, they called it, I'm sorry, an ungrateful volcano, yes. And we will not solve Iraq. We will not solve it. And this is no fault of the U.S. military. A National Guardsman from Kansas City cannot be expected to patrol the streets of Baghdad or Basra or Diyala province and impose order. It's not going to happen. We can train our military and 200,000 soldiers in Arabic, fluent Arabic, and we still can't control it. Iraq is not a real country. And very pragmatically, let me reduce it to this. Do we care if Iran is the predominant power in Iraq? I don't. I lost two bosses killed by the Iranians, a lot of colleagues. But I really hate to use this cliche, but it's time to move on and look at the realities. And how do we contain Iran? We also have to look at the fact that Iran unleashed and uncontained could get a lot more dangerous. So let me paint a disaster scenario, and that is Mubarak in Egypt falls. You have chaos. You have a fight between the army and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood wins. They are Sunni, yet they are being supported by Iran. All of a sudden, on Israel's border, we have a hostile Syria, we have a hostile Lebanon controlled by Hezbollah, we have a wobbling monarchy in Jordan, and a hostile power in Egypt. This is what could happen in unleashed Iran, that if we don't deal pragmatically with Iran's new power. We need to look at the essential propaganda message of Iran. We have to look at the reality of its power in the Persian Gulf and Iraq and Lebanon, but we have to look at that, and it's the Israeli-Arab conflict. The Iranians have gotten enormous mileage out of this conflict. The fact that their surrogate organization in Lebanon beat the Israelis has had enormous resonance across the Middle East. Enormous. And if you're the most formidable army, probably man per man in the world is the Israeli army. They have just won every war hands down, including 73. When they were under the gun in 73, they turned around, they took back the Sinai. They drove the Egyptians back across the Suez Canal. 67, they defeated every Arab country. So when this Iranian-backed guy comes along, Hassan Nasrallah, and actually bloodies the Israelis' nose, it's like any situation, everybody's looking at him. They don't care he's a cleric. They don't care he's Iranian-backed. All they know is guy fought back. He remains the hero. And the fact that in Lebanon he is not moved to actually occupy the country or convert Sunnis to Shia Islam and has stayed in the south and has built up the military has only improved his power. What we have to do in a very Machiavellian way is undercut that, and this is find a solution the Arab-Israeli problem. And I fall back on Resolution 242, 1967. You give the Palestinians a state in the West Bank. You give them one in Gaza. You give a slice of Jerusalem. You close down the settlements. And you say, this is international law. And what you're doing is narrowing down the base of the extremists to the point where they become irrelevant. Look, and let me stray off from Iran. Osama bin Laden is completely irrelevant, totally irrelevant. We don't care about him. He has not made an attack. And trust me, if he had any support in this country, he could do it. Among these documentaries I did one on car bombs and actually went through the motions of making explosives in London and places like that. It took us 2 hours in London to go to a local, their equivalent of a hardware store, get acetone and peroxide, and buy detonators. If there were any true support for bin Laden, we'd be seeing bombs go off in Lafayette or San Francisco or malls like that. Where is bin Laden? Well, he's either dead. He hasn't appeared on a tape in years, since a verifiable tape since October 2001, or he's so sick he's irrelevant. The last tape he came out was 2007. Focusing on Pakistan and looking for the man has become a waste of time. So we're just pushing Pakistan over the edge. I just spent the last year there. It's time to re-gear. And I'll say something. I'm going to go way off into you know, probably in the, a lot of people think is La La Land, but the Middle East in a lot of ways is irrelevant. I mean, we have never truly lost the supply of oil since 73. We did for a short period. It was for a month. The Iranians have never stopped pumping oil. They need our technology. They need us. The problem is that when we get into their conflicts, we become bogged down, and we don't help. The best wishes. That the United States is not an imperialist country. We don't want to occupy these countries. We want to fix them. But unfortunately, we're just really bad at empire. I spent 21 years in the CIA at the edge of this empire, and I wasn't very good at it. And we just don't do it well. We really have to think about coming home. And we also have to, this country is emotionally, irrevocably tied to Israel, as we are to Great Britain. It's just part of our makeup as people. We have to find a way not to push Israel to extremes. And I actually have a lot of hope that Netanyahu, in a coalition with Labor, is the guy to open up to Iran. And the fact that Peres also went on Nowruz and made this address, and the Israelis that I talk to think that attacking Iran is a bridge too far. You really have to go back and you look at the map and a great alliance, you know, this sounds like Candyland, but would be between Iran and Israel. And I'd like to open up to questions, challenges, even better. Just don't throw tomatoes. Don't throw shoes. I'm really slow.
Let's take some questions from the audience. And before that, let's thank Robert Baer for that conversation, that talk on the devil we know and his book. We do have questions. The first question I received was a question about President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton. And as you pointed out, Robert, President Obama did do a video message in which he said to the Iranian people, "Eid Shoma Mubarak," which means essentially "Happy Nowruz" or "Happy congratulations on a festival." But are moves like that, which garnered a lot of headlines, are they formidable moves, or is it really just a show in a way to kind of lay the groundwork for something that might happen later on?
I still have a lot of optimism about this administration foreign policy. We've backed down from the rhetoric. You know, you don't threaten Iran. What you do is you offer them something, and if they still continue to build a bomb and a missile, then you move to military means. You just don't threaten. These are empty threats. So I think the fact that we've stepped down from threats we do not intend to carry out, I think it was clearly the military has, you know, by the way, I don't like to advertise my book, but the people that like my book the most, and a lot of people don't like it, is the military. I have a huge fan club in the military because we have looked through the same prism at Iran, and I share views with senior officers that right now, with the size of our military, Iran is a bridge too far. But on the Obama speech is what the Iranians are saying, yeah, this is a great idea, but we want the following things. We don't want to say, all right, we're going to give up our nuclear, our weapons. We're not going to get up our nuclear facilities. We want something in return. And what we need to do is get down to the hard quid pro quo, what we're ready to give the Iranians. And then I think what you're going to see is a real opening up. And the fact that Hillary Clinton invited Iran to talk about Afghanistan is a good start. Because Afghanistan is not just our Achilles heel, it's the Iranians. Because if that slips into chaos, the Taliban come back, they'll start funding the Sunni fundamentalists in Iran, and mosques are going to get blown up again. And the Iranians know this. Because we are not, the Iranians haven't defeated us because we can push back. We can push back in Iraq. You want to push back in Iraq, we just get up and leave next month. It'll be total chaos in their borders and leave Afghanistan. And you want to see the Mad Max approach to the Middle East, you would see it. And the Iranians know that, and we should go to them and say it. You know, we are on the same side on this, the problem of chaos in the Middle East. We have to work together. But we really need to sit down in a secret agenda, in secret talks, and offer them you know, they want things, and they're a power to be reckoned with. We just can't say do this, do that, and we'll see what you get at the end of the bargaining. It doesn't work.
Iran has been in the news for definitely the last 5 years or so because of its efforts to get nuclear technology. Now, in your book, the Devil We Know, you talk about how, in a way, this is really not that important to Iran, that it's really kind of, to use a cliche, their ace in the hole, and that their long-term interests really have more to do with taking over oil fields and taking control of Iraq, and et cetera. A question from the audience is what about the fact that Iran has threatened to use nuclear weapons?
I don't think Iran is a suicidal state. I think it was in 79. I think in 79, President Carter should have bombed Abadan when they didn't give our diplomats back and just flattened it. But excuse me, I used to work for the CIA. We tend to become a bit exaggerated. That was the time to hit them. But since then, Iran has become a much more rational state, and they're certainly not going to risk being erased from the map, because that's exactly what Israel do. I would not want to take the Israelis on nuke. You know, they have a second response. The Iranians, last couple of years, at any point, could have started World War III. They could have started systematically a resistance in Iraq, killing a lot of American soldiers. And trust me, they can do it if they want to. There's no way to control Basra without the help of the locals. The locals are loyal to Iran. So I don't think they're going to use their nuclear weapons, but I still don't want them, because what we should worry about is if they get a nuclear weapon, they're going to start an arms race in the Middle East, because the Saudis are going to want one, and the Bahrainis are going to want one, and everybody's going to want one, and the Pakistanis are going under, and they'll sell anything right now. So that we don't, you know, that's a catastrophe scenario. They don't usually happen, but that's one. So that's why I don't want them to have a nuclear weapon. But what they do need is nuclear technology, clean nuclear technology, enriched uranium at a low degree, because they have to get off oil. 70 million people. They're running out of oil very quickly. The world has reached peak oil. They're going to have to feed these people. So what they want to do is for their economy is use nuclear power and export their oil, which is a very reasonable demand. We have to get into the stream of this, help them, make sure they don't enrich their uranium, don't start an arms race. I think we can talk them out of it. I could be very wrong, but I think we can talk them out of a nuclear weapon. We talked Argentina out of one. We talked South Africa out of one. And if you accept my premise that they're a rational power, they can be talked out of it.
You mentioned in your book not only Iran's future, but really at the end of the book you say that the U.S. should really become an ally with Iran. And you talk about, of course, the title of your book suggests this, that the United States should treat Iran as an equal. A question from the audience is, if we recognize Iran as the key power in the Persian Gulf area, should we insist that they forgo their support for terrorist groups, and would they ever agree to this?
I think they probably would. I mean, I think it'd be part of the grand bargain. And grand bargains, you know, we got one of those with China in 1972 with Nixon, conservative president. They would. I mean, you know, I talk about them backing away from terrorism. I don't know if you remember in 2005, I believe, five American soldiers were killed at Karbala. I have a hunch, and people have told me in the military they were killed by the Iranians because we took five of their diplomats. You know, it's for what it's worth. But yes, I think we need to get them into the position. They stop giving rockets to Hezbollah. They stop supporting Sunni fundamentalist groups, which they are in some parts of the world. They have to stop supporting the extremist groups and Hamas. And I think they'll give it up. But again, it's a quid pro quo. We're not going to get this for nothing. It's going to cost us.
A reminder to our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Baer, a former top CIA operative, about what Americans do and don't know about Iran in the Middle East. A lot of people have only seen Iran through movies and documentaries. you've spent some time there yourself, and in your book, you talk about meeting with clerics, some of whom don't particularly like you when you meet them. You were, speak fluent Farsi, fluent Arabic as well. What is your sense? I mean, as you talk about in your book, you know, the Americans tend to demonize Iran, but do Iranians demonize America the way we think they do, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, they demonize us unfairly. I mean, I've read the Mossadegh file. It was the premier overthrown in 1953. And let's be fair. Yes, the CIA had part of this. Norman Schwarzkopf's father had part of it. The ambassador, British Petroleum, and blah, blah, blah. But the Shah was essentially the one who got rid of Mossadegh. We did not destroy Iranian democracy. This is a myth. We interfered, and we tried to destroy it, in a sense. But we didn't do it. The Iranians did that. The corruption in Iran under the Shah, did we contribute to it? Yes, we contributed to it. But are we responsible for Iran's... The corruption continues. It's worse than it was under the Shah, probably, according to some Iranians. So, yes, they do demonize us, and there's a Persian call, you know, trait of blaming somebody on the outside. I mean, it sounds like my family, but in any case, we have to get over that, but they're very attuned. They spend a lot of time on the internet. They know American music. They want to learn. They like Americans. It's a country of contradictions. I'll tell you why they didn't like me. And I went to Qom and I sat down with this Ayatollah and started speaking to him the language of the Prophet in Arabic. He couldn't speak it. And that was a mistake. But I never said I was a diplomat. So he switched to Persian. There's so many contradictions. It's such a complicated country. It's a country that is once a semi-democracy and is a police state. There's an FBI agent that disappeared in Quiche Island 2 years ago. And they was probably killed by the police. So we're not talking about a benign power. We are talking about a power that's in transformation, that wants to become a democracy, that it, at the same time is very advanced in many sciences and nanotechnology, in rockets, as we know, and in warfare, and yet it's a police state. You do not want to end up in Evin prison because you'll never get out. But we can improve their disposition by reducing the paranoia, by opening channels, by talking, by cooperating on Afghanistan, Iraq, and as a second stage on the Palestinian-Israeli problem.
One of the surprising things in your book, The Devil We Know, is your at the end, your address about Saudi Arabia. And you suggest that the U.S. become an ally of Iran and essentially let Iran eventually have control of the sacred cities.
Don't trust me on Saudi Arabia. I just don't like the Saudi royal family. I have a bias against them. I have a really big problem is that 9/11 was paid for by Saudi funding out of Mecca. The mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was in hiding in Qatar for several years. No one has ever answered where's this network? How did those 15 Saudis end up on the airplanes? That really bothers me. And I'm not saying there's a conspiracy. I'm just, you know, I would like to know. I mean, is it going to happen again? I don't really care. I'm not a Muslim. I'm a Methodist for what it's worth. But I don't care whether the Shia or the Sunni control Mecca. The Shia believe they've been oppressed since 680, since the murder of the Prophet, the Prophet's grandson, Hussein. Why can't they co-administer Mecca? It's an issue Americans should not get involved in. It should be between the Saudis and the Iranians. I think what the Saudis would like us to do is demonstrate that we can handle the Iranian problem, and they'll feel a lot better about it. Excuse me.
Okay, yeah, the question from our audience is, will you address the position of Saudi Arabia to Iran And in your book, you spend a lot of time talking about the relationship between the countries and how Saudi Arabia is essentially scared to death about what would happen if the United States were to leave.
And well, I would be scared to death, too. You know, my prejudice aside, if you're sitting there, because Iran has can put a million men in uniform very quickly, the Saudis, the last battle they fought was in 1991, and they were thoroughly defeated. It was a Marine company that came and saved them. They ran for it. They don't have an army. The Iranians do. It would take the Iranians, this may be an exaggeration, 45 minutes, you know, to land their paratroopers in Riyadh, and it'd be over if it weren't for the Fifth Fleet. Yeah, they should be scared. And I don't I'm not advocating we just hand Saudi Arabia over to Iran. I'm just saying that we have to reassure them we know what we're doing with Iran. What terrifies the Saudis is we're going to get really tired of Iraq. We're going to get tired of Afghanistan. We're going to get up and leave. America is going to return to isolationism, and they are left with to pick up the pieces, and they can't do it. And no, we do not want Saudi Arabia to collapse. It's got the cheapest oil in the world. It's $1 to $2 a barrel to lift it. It's accessible to the Persian Gulf. But they should be scared.
Now, a lot of Americans, and I'm a journalist, a lot of Americans get their news from the media, such as me. In August of 2007, you quoted a Bush administration official as saying there will be an attack on Iran, and there wasn't. And I'm wondering, like anyone who relies on government sources for information, your sources can be wrong. And what do you do to filter through biases in the people you interview, and for that matter, your own biases? You talk about your bias against Saudi Arabia.
Well, in 2007, the Bush administration went to the Pentagon, said, start looking at advanced plans for attacking Iran. And I wrote an article for Time, a column, and then I wrote a second one after that that Bush came in the administration. It would be too expensive to go to war with Iran. So there was a follow-up. But in 2007, the military was advised to look at an attack on Iran. I think they came to their senses. They sat down and said, it's too costly. We'd have to put, 10 divisions in the Persian Gulf to face the reaction. I think that Dick Cheney desperately wanted to attack Iran. I mean, he said that as much. And he was vetoed. He was vetoed by Bush. And we know that the Israelis talked to Bush about it in a visit to Tel Aviv, said, let's do the attack now. And Bush thought about it and came back to him. Said no.
In See No Evil, this is a question from the audience, you wrote that you were investigated by the U.S. government for allegedly plotting to assassinate Saddam Hussein, and I know you've addressed this in your book about how it was...
I did plot to assassinate him.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I tell the story. We were in northern Iraq, and it was... You know, it was for some reason the only TV we could get. We had a generator. I was chief of station. And it was Bon Jovi weekend. It probably just drove me over the end. Anyhow, this Iraqi general came to me and said, let's get rid of the guy. Look, Saddam Hussein is the problem. Not the military, not the Iraqis. He's the problem. He's out of his mind. And I will not ruin your dinners by telling you stories about Saddam that worse than you've ever heard. You just don't want to hear them. It's him and his sons are the problem. So these Iraqi generals came to me and said, will you support a coup against Saddam, a military coup? We can leave everything in place. But the idea is there's going to be no invasion. We give up what's left of the weapons of mass destruction. And I said, why not? And I proceeded to send messages. I have communications with Washington. Sent probably 15 messages back to the White House. What I didn't know is that my boss at the Near East Division stopped those messages and did not send them to Tony Lake, who was the National Security Advisor. And so the Iraqis said, what does this mean? I said, I don't know, but I guess it's your country. Do what you want to do. If you want to box Saddam in Tikrit, flatten his house and get rid of him, it's your country. I think it's a good idea. This is operating on the edge. This is the way you do in the CIA, you know. No one told me no, so I said, let's do it. That worked in fine until General Shali Kashvili got a call at 4 in the morning at his house and saying, "Sir, we now have the Iranian army on full alert, and they're moving platforms and armor up to the border, and we've got the Turkish army's gone on full alert, and we got the Iraqi army's gone on Jim alert, is on full alert, and there's, I mean, it was I'll tell you, it was wild. There's airplanes flying all over. There was shooting. The Kurds overran 3 Division, and I'm sitting there, and I remember calling back and saying, I've got 4,000 Iraqi prisoners. And I was sitting in the stadium in Erbil with, you know, my REI jacket on and a Kalashnikov. What do I do with them? And Washington said, "Well, you know, we don't know. You know, get rid, you know." So anyhow, it was a typical federal government fiasco. And this, it happens. I'm sorry. And then Tony Lake said, "What's going on?" Because my boss had forgot to tell him the CIA, and so he assumed it was a rogue CIA coup, even though it was completely documented. And this has been investigated by the Senate, and there's Senate reports you can find on the net, I think. It was an opportunity. I mean, if I could go back and get rid of the guy, I would. And let's forget the morality of it. We wouldn't be in Iraq. And we would have a general there, a Saddam Light, who would be talking to, and we wouldn't... Yeah, I know. And then we wouldn't have the Iranians creeping in and taking Iraq. We wouldn't be... I wouldn't have written this book on Iran. I'd probably still be in the CIA, you know, probably selling Coca-Colas, but, you know, in the cafeteria. But I thought it was a good idea.
Do you have are there other things that you actually regret not doing or doing in your 20-plus years in the CIA? Or, correspondingly, is there something that you're most proud of in your tenure in the CIA?
No, I mean, I was, you know, I consider myself a professional. I wish I'd been a better case officer. I wish I'd recruited a Soviet diplomat or a Soviet military officer that had gotten the Politburo. That's what I regret. That was what we were hired to do. And sorry, you know, I didn't do it.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Baer, former top CIA operative, about what Americans do and do not know about Iran and the Middle East. One of the things to learn from your book, newest book, is the fact that in Basra, Iran essentially controls it through proxies.
It's an empire by proxies. It's a good question. I mean, they don't. You know, if you got a real job and you go to work every day and you come home and you read the Chronicle and you say, "Well, there's no Iranians in Basra. There's no. I haven't seen a single picture of them." That's because they know better. They're not going to put people in uniform. The Iranians are very smart. They find people that go along. The Wall Street Journal last week, very great article, is that Iranian goods are infiltrating Iraq to the point where Iranian industry is falling apart. I mean, Iraqi industry is falling apart. They can't compete with the Iranians. This is a very subtle encroachment. And you want to find people that listen to you. You don't have to own them, but to go along with the plan. It's like the Third International in communism, except it's much more effective. You will not see in Beirut a single Iranian officer in uniform. I've spent many years there. I never saw one. They're very used to see them in the Bekaa early on, but then they figured out, no, we don't need them here. It's a magnet for the world's attention. So they sent them home. But what they find is fellow travelers. And by the way, forget this stuff about, well, the price of oil's down, the Iranians are going to give up their empire. They were at their height in 1999 and 1998 when the barrel of oil was $10. So this is not going to slow them down.
One of the other things that was news to me from your book is that the Iranians have control, in some sense, financial control over Kurds in Iraq. And you talk about how this would be a contradiction in some sense, but it's not. A question from the audience is what are your thoughts on Iraq being divided into three parts, essentially Kurdish, Sunni, and Shia?
Let's partition it. The Kurds are not going to give back Kurdistan to Iraq, to Baghdad. They're just not. They're going to fight for every inch of it. They've been effectively independent since 1990, since the first Gulf War. They're not going back. They're not going to put themselves under a Shia government. They're not going to put themselves under a Sunni government. The Sunnis, look at the New York Times this week, are very upset that they got betrayed on this awakening, the Anbar movement, the surge. Divide it. divided. I think the Iraqis, we could, if it's done with the help of the Iranians, the help of the Saudis, partition the country, give Baghdad to the Shia. It's already 80% Shia. It's not exactly one man, one vote, but let's just acknowledge the facts on the ground. And I think the Iraq, I mean, look, let's put it this way. We Iraqis are better off, the Iraqis that survived the war without Saddam. It is a more civil society today than it was in 2003. But that doesn't mean that we should, you know, we should be in a position of waiting 30 years to create our kind of democracy. They're going to have whatever kind they have. And I think you're going to see the majority sect is going to be calling major decisions. And the Sunnis are going to be very upset about it. But if there's some sort of federalism or partition, it's going to be a lot easier, and especially if the Sunni are backed by the Saudis financially, because there's not much oil. There's a little bit of gas in Anbar province, but not much.
Another question from the audience. You mentioned at the beginning that the U.S. was at war with Iran between, say, 78 and 79, 1996. What happened in 1996 that would mark the end of that war? Or really, is it an ongoing war in that way?
My theory is, and this is a theory, and usually theories, you know, not supported by facts on Iran are wrong, but is that by 1996, they didn't need terrorism anymore. There was a big argument in the Iranian government whether they should be attacking U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia. These radicals won. There's also an extremist radical part of the government that went out in 1999 and started killing dissidents. I really can't predict what they're going to do or how powerful they are today. But what we do see is the Iranians stopping Hezbollah in 1996 and 1997 from committing international terrorism. There were groups in Hezbollah said, now's the time to hit the Israelis during the elections. Let's set off car bombs in Tel Aviv. Let's kill Americans. And the Iranians came down and said no. They became a much more mature power at that point. And it's a rough division.
You mentioned the idea that Israel and Iran could actually get together diplomatically. Now, of course, before the fall of the Shah, those two countries were very much together. A question from the audience is, what other than religion would motivate Iran to form an alliance with Israel? I mean, practically speaking, how would that actually work?
Well, I mean, it would work in the sense of coming to some sort of entente on nuclear weapons, entente on the Persian Gulf, entente on, I mean, Israel has no oil or gas itself. This, you know, for instance, one gas pipeline proposal is running it across from the Gulf, Syria, down the Lebanese coast into Israel. For Israeli power needs, this would have to be signed off on by Iran. Iran's real center of power is the Persian Gulf. It's not the Mediterranean. And I don't believe that their aspirations for empire really go to the Mediterranean. I think they know that's a bridge too far. And so the Israelis get the Mediterranean. I mean, this is a very broad stroke exaggeration of dividing the world up, but it does serve a purpose.
Well, one purpose for some Americans is actually that they want to travel to Iran. I've been to Iran twice. I know there are actually tours that will take Americans to Iran. And one question from the audience is whether you've seen the Rick Steves program on Iran. And the other question actually related to that is, comment on taking a tour of Iran. Is this a good idea?
Absolutely. I'd go to Iran. I mean, when I went to Iran, I was publicly identified with the CIA. And when I got off at the airport, at Khomeini Airport, this brand new airport, absolutely beautiful airport, by the way, very organized and everybody's very polite. And they pull me aside to say, Mr. Baer, would you come with us? I said, you know, my mother was right. I'm half an idiot. So, but anyhow, it was to fingerprint me because I was a journalist and we fingerprint them. But, you know, if a CIA guy can go in that used to deal with the Iranian opposition for years and did not write well about them in his first book, if he can go in and then be hosted by the office of Ahmadinejad, you can go. You can't do something crazy there. There's no American consulate to call up if you get arrested. But if you're a tourist, they'll treat you well. It's a fascinating place, extraordinarily sophisticated culture, and you go with good questions and catch up with the latest rock and roll, and you'll be welcomed and embraced.
In some ways, though, aren't you given preferential treatment because of your memoir having inspired the George Clooney movie Syriana? In fact, that movie version of your book has elevated you in a lot of people's eyes. This may or may not be related. The State Department, I've read, is encouraging you to come by as often as possible because they want to hear your thoughts on Iran. In some ways,
well, it's not exactly true. We adopted a little girl in Pakistan last year, and after all these years, my wife finally convinced me that I have to listen to the lawyer. And so we go to the courtroom. It's a little nasty courtroom in Rawalpindi, and this meeting's going on in Urdu, and I don't understand this. So the judge turns to me and says in Urdu, "What's your bona fides, for an adoption?" And the lawyer says, "Give him a copy of Syriana." So I give him the copy of Syriana and says, "What's this?" And the lawyer tells the judge, "Oh, Mr. Bob and his wife are in the CIA. And if he could have, he would have flown out the window." It wasn't until we got out and been turned down for the adoption that I found out that he was from the Taliban. So Syriana will only get you so far. We had to go to a higher court, and we got the little girl. But it worked out well. A happy story. It does give you a certain cover, Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood's a great cover for getting into areas. And we went to Damascus with the director when we were filming this, and the director is Stephen Gagan. He did Traffic, if you've seen that. He looks Hollywood, the diaphanous shirt and stuff. And so we're driving along, and the presidency calls up and says, "Mr. Bob, Mr. Gagan, you can have anything you want in Damascus." And so we look at each other, and we have no idea. We're making a movie. This isn't serious. He looks at me and says, "Let's go see the oil minister." And so cell phone 5 minutes later, "Yes, go see him." So we're right outside the door of the oil ministry. It's Thursday night. It's their weekend. And then the presidency calls up and says, "All right, it's fine, but you don't say you're CIA, and you don't, Mr. Gagan, you don't say you're Hollywood." I said, "Well, what do we tell this guy why we're here?" He says, "Make it up." This is from the Syrian presidency. The Middle East is a very odd place. So we go in, and we sit down with the minister, and Gagan, the director, opens his notebook and starts taking notes, and this lady in a muhajaba sitting next to the minister, he says, "I'm listening. I've been told to listen to you. What's your project?" So I proceed, being a professional liar, to talk about building a pipeline across Syria. And Gagan, the director, just can't hold himself. He's just starting to laugh as I'm just making all this up, pretending to be oil consultants. But anyhow, it does get you a certain access, Hollywood, but not...
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Baer, former top CIA operative, about what Americans do and do not know about Iran and the Middle East. Let's take another question from the audience. Iranians generally are not religious at all, this person says, and the Islamic Revolution happened based on a U.S. plan. Would you comment on that?
I don't think they're particularly religious. The Iranians, when an astounding fact is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, doesn't sound any more Islamic than anything I can imagine, voted for Khatami, who's fairly secular. In the election. The Iranians that deal a lot with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps will tell me stories. These people are secular. They are purely interested in power politics. Now, the other thing I hear a lot from Iran is the mullahs are a hindrance in the sense is they represent something, the margins of Iran. And what people are really concerned about is unemployment, which is close to 30%, and inflation is 30%. They have serious economic problems. And they know at the same time, if they were to get rid of the mullahs, it's not going to change a whole lot. They really don't have the appetite for a revolution. And I'm passing on the views of Iranians. I'm not going to comment on it. So we shouldn't expect a revolution in Iran. you know, here's the theory on Islam is that this is both true of, particularly true of Britain, MI6, and Israeli Mossad, in a lot of ways invented the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood was an invention of the West. I mean, it rose by itself. I mean, it obviously morphed into something else because Britain, MI6, wanted to fight Nasser and Nasserism, secularism, and communism. And the way to do it was using Islam. The Israelis supported Hamas in its early years to fight Arafat. They figured, you know, divide and conquer. That it morphed, as I said, morphed into something they couldn't control. So we did nothing to help the secular regimes in the Middle East, including the Shah, that would have staved off a lot of this. But then again, you know, let's don't forget we were fighting the Cold War. Let's don't forget it was the Cold War. It all made sense to the people back then. You know, the Soviet Union had rockets trained at this country, and we had rockets in Cuba. And so if someone said, let's support the Muslims because they're going to undermine the communists, that's an argument you could have never won in Washington, and there was a good reason for it.
You've been to Iran, Iraq. As you said, you speak fluent Farsi and Arabic. And it has surprised you the way you've been accepted as a former CIA officer in the Middle East. You're talking about being embraced in a way. But there are also parts in your book where you say you've been given the cold shoulder. I think there's part in the book where you talk about going to Iraq's border with Iran and where you met with some clerical leaders there. And it was very awkward, your conversations with them. Can you talk about this moment? It surprised you how Iran essentially controlled this part of Iraq. And this was a good example of how you say Iran really uses proxies to fight its war.
Well, this was very remote parts of Iraq that were controlled by Iran. I mean, I like to be on the ground and really, touch the people, as they say. When we're going up there and Hezbollah has given us an escort to drive to the border, and I'm in the CIA at this point, and the man that jumps in the car introduces himself as from the Iranian Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Inside Iraq, I start, the Iranians have inroads into this country. I've seen all I want. And the Iranians didn't trust us. I mean, I was not helping the situation. I went to Panjween, which is on the border, and the Kurds were yelling and screaming about being shelled from Iran. And so in an impromptu speech, I went on about 20 minutes about Persian imperialism, how we'll never put up with this. And the president of Iraq, Taliban, he said, well, you know, when the Iranians came, said, who's this guy giving a speech on our border? He said, do you think the speech is bad? I'm getting a Marine division coming up here. So this was our sense of humor in the CIA. But no, they don't trust us. They've got their own interests, and they don't trust the CIA. I mean, the CIA's got a bad reputation. I mean, I have a hard time overcoming writing. I'd be a lot better off if I were writing as a professor from Stanford this book, because people say, why would you believe a CIA guy? You know, it's really hard to come across that, is that I'm out of the CIA, and this is what I saw. And I can't tell you my sources because I have to submit my books to the CIA, but this is what I saw, you know. That's my real obstacle. My obstacle, I have as many obstacles in this country as I do in Iran.
Well, why can't you submit your sources? Why can't you lay out in a more obvious way who your sources are?
The National Security Act states very clearly that if I talk about sensitive sources and methods, I can go to jail. And I don't disagree with that act. There are ways to collect intelligence that are very secret. There are things that, and I shouldn't be talking about it. It's not my decision to expose them. And secondly, no one cares. I mean, do you care how you get into a fiber optic cable? No, you don't care. It doesn't improve the argument any. So, but it's the prejudice against the CIA. And the Bush administration did nothing to help it with the torture. Torture is a waste of time. You know why we know? Because we've seen reports from torture. They know torture doesn't work. The French tried it in Algeria. It didn't work. The Lebanese tried it. The Saudis tried it. It doesn't work. It's a tool of intimidation. The people that figured this out very early on is the FBI. It got its intelligence by simple civil police interrogations. And I think that's totally off the subject of Iran. But what I'm trying to say is getting my point across. You have that prejudice against the CIA.
Well, actually, that segues into a question about torture. You were quoted as saying a couple years ago, if you want a serious interrogation, you send a prisoner to Jordan. If you want them to be tortured, you send them to Syria. If you want someone to disappear, never to see them again, you send them to Egypt.
And that's true.
Yeah. What's the context of that quote? Were you being asked about?
I think it was the Arar case where it was a Canadian was grabbed in New York, sent to Washington, Washington to Jordan, and then Jordan was taken to Syria where he was tortured. In the Palestinian section, and the Syrians very rightly said, this guy's not Qaeda, we looked at him, we know his background, they let him go under Canadian pressure. The Egyptians are a very violent dictatorial regime, and if you do not want to end up in Egyptian prison because you may never be found again. And the Jordanians were trained by the Brits, they're very good, they're very thorough. They're very good with the Palestinians, and they're very professional officers. And that's been our experience.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Robert Baer, former top CIA operative, about what Americans do and do not know about Iran in the Middle East. We're down to the last couple of minutes here. You were raised in Aspen, Colorado, and I've read that you aspired early on to be a professional skier. Now, a question from the audience.
Ski racer, excuse me.
A question from the audience is, what spurred your interest in Iran and Middle East politics? How do you go from aspiring ski racer to, studying about mullahs in Qom, Iran?
Well, I went to Aspen High School, and it's probably not the best place to get an education. Anyhow, I exceeded their expectations because I got straight Fs, and my mother sent me to military school, and I was ready to become a skier even at that point. And she said, no, why don't you try college? And I ended up in Berkeley. And I was sleeping on the couch of a friend. And as boys will do, they're 21 years old. We started talking about our futures. And he said, he worked for Bank of America. And he said, why don't you get a job? And I said, well, the economy's bad. I'm unemployable. I don't know how to do anything. He says, well, then apply to the CIA. So I called up. You know, teenage boy. Well, I was almost a teenager. So I call up the Federal Center, and they give me a number in Lawndale, California. Has anybody seen Lawndale, California? And the CIA office at that time was in an auto mall. Don't ask me why. And they send me an application, which is about 5,000 pages. And only somebody who's unemployed with nothing to do would fill it out. So I filled it out, and never expecting to hear again from the CIA, and they called me to some hotel, the Hilton downtown, and it was all very odd. And they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be an analyst. I was studying Chinese at the time, and they said, oh, forget it. You need a PhD. How do you want to do this, this James Bond stuff? Absolutely positive I wasn't get hired, so I said, sure, I'll do it. And then they called me up, and they said, can you be there in 2 weeks? I can be there next week. I owned a Ford Torino, which had caught on fire a couple weeks before. It was all burned on the hood. And so I abandoned my car and showed up in the CIA. And I asked to study Chinese, and they said, nope, we need people, Arabic speakers. And I guess I was an accidental spy, to answer your question.
Accidental spy. We're down to probably one last question here. How important would the Middle East be if the U.S. develops alternative fuels, as the Obama administration hopes to do? I know a lot of your book is premised on the fact that oil will be in demand for the foreseeable future, and that if it continues to be in demand, then Iran is really sitting pretty, as it were.
Well, there's two parts to that. The question is, when does the oil run out? I'm not a geologist, and I'm not an oil official. But I keep on seeing articles by very responsible people, the chairman of Total Oil, who says we've reached peak oil. We're going to be running out of oil. In the meantime, we've got about 20 or 30 years to keep a lid on the Middle East because we need that oil. You look at the Marshall Plan, and at the end of the day, the Marshall Plan succeeded because we had cheap oil. You could get Europe's industry back. If you look at this recession, I'm struck by the the fact that it started when the oil hit $147 a barrel. And it was like almost, it hit $147 a barrel. People were out of their cars. They stopped going to the malls. They stopped shopping. They stopped doing all these things. And then we go into a recession. Oil is going to be important. As I said, we need cheap oil to get out of this recession. I mean, I walk as much as I can, but we need people to be able to get to work, to afford it. And we need a breathing period to get into alternative energy sources. And that's way beyond my competence. It's not stopped me before talking about things beyond my competence. But there's got to be a way that we give up oil. I mean, not because for moral reasons or just for the environment, we're running out. And in the meantime, we have to keep a lid on the Middle East at the least possible cost and the least amount of bloodshed. And that's why we have to make the grand bargain with Iran.
Our thanks to Robert Baer, former CIA operative and author of the new book, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.